Thank you, and welcome to today's American Bankruptcy Institute teleconference to examine the Supreme Court's ruling in Stern versus Marshall, handed down yesterday. I am ABI resident scholar Jean Brouker, also a law professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona, and I will be your moderator for the teleconference. Before introducing our speakers, I'd like to give a little background on the case. The Supreme Court held in Stern versus Marshall that bankruptcy courts lack constitutional authority to enter a final judgment in a state common law action that is asserted by a debtor as a counterclaim to a creditor's claim in bankruptcy. Chief Justice Roberts, in his 5-4 opinion for the majority, began by quoting Charles Dickens' Bleak House about the case of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. As in the fictional and foggy case in that novel, both the litigants in Stern versus Marshall are dead, and so the dispute is between their estates. It reads like a soap opera. The debtor who filed in bankruptcy was the celebrity and former Playboy model Anna Nicole Smith, who used the name Vicki Lynn Marshall privately. She was born Vicki Lynn Hogan. She was in her 20s when she met Texas oilman J. Howard Marshall, who was then in his 80s, more than 60 years her senior. They married a few years later, and he died about a year after that. Her opponent in the ensuing legal battle was Marshall's son, Pierce. Anna Nicole and Pierce have both since died. The result in the case is that Anna Nicole's 4-year-old daughter, Danielle Lynn, will not recover something in the neighborhood of $474 million that was awarded by the bankruptcy court in California, and the money will stay with the Marshall clan. The Supreme Court refers to the parties as Vicki and Pierce in the various opinions, so I will do the same. After Vicki filed in bankruptcy, Pierce sued her for defamation on the basis of allegations she had accused him of using fraud to cheat her out of her rights as a widow. Pierce brought that defamation claim in the bankruptcy case and filed a proof of claim. Vicki responded with a defense of truth and a counterclaim that Pierce had tortiously deprived her of an expected gift that she alleged her husband had promised her. Now, turning from the particular case, we are more concerned here with its implications for the bankruptcy system. The majority decision stressed that bankruptcy courts are not Article III courts, because bankruptcy judges are appointed for 14-year terms rather than life tenure and don't have protection against reductions in salary, which are the requirements under the Constitution for Article III judges. Rather, bankruptcy judges are Article I officials who draw their authority from congressional delegation. The status of bankruptcy judges is complex in that they are appointed by Article III judges who sit on the U.S. Courts of Appeals. The Supreme Court reasoned that Article III judges, those who sit at the level of federal district court, court of appeals, or the Supreme Court itself, are guardians of separation of powers. They are part of the system of checks and balances of our federal government, and that requires having the judiciary independent of Congress and the president. The majority also stressed that Article III judges are guardians of individual liberty because of the independence that they get from having life tenure. The court objected to having a bankruptcy judge issue a final judgment in a state law counterclaim to a creditor's claim brought in bankruptcy court. The Supreme Court interpreted the bankruptcy procedure statute to give the bankruptcy courts the power to decide such counterclaims and found that Pierce had consented to jurisdiction. However, the court found that the statutory scheme was unconstitutional. So the result for the bankruptcy system is that bankruptcy judges can no longer decide state law counterclaims to creditors' claims, but federal district courts can. The court split along common lines, with Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito joining the Chief Justice in the majority. Justice Scalia concurred in a separate opinion to emphasize even more than Justice Roberts the importance of having Article III judges decide many issues in the bankruptcy context. Justice Breyer wrote the dissent, joined by Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. The dissent emphasizes practical concerns such as delay and increased cost if federal district court judges must decide compulsory counterclaims based on state law causes of action that are asserted in bankruptcy cases. The dissent gives an example of a tenant filing in bankruptcy with a claim asserted by the landlord for unpaid rent, and the tenant then raising counterclaims, including a claim that the landlord failed to fulfill obligations as the lessor. Under Stern versus Marshall, the counterclaim will have to go to the federal district court. Justice Breyer noted what he called the staggering volume of bankruptcy cases, 1.6 million in 2010, compared to 280,000 civil cases in federal court nationally and 78,000 criminal cases. The dissenting opinion also raises the question of whether there is in this decision a threat to the ability of administrative agencies to decide cases. And several agencies are listed, such as the National Labor Relations Board, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. In other words, Justice Breyer, an administrative law expert, is concerned about implications both in the bankruptcy system and beyond that context. Today's program will begin with about 30 minutes of commentary by our experts. We will then take your questions. Let me now introduce today's speakers, two of whom were involved in the case by being involved in submissions of amicus briefs. So the first person I'll introduce is the Honorable Kevin J. Carey, who is Chief U.S. Bankruptcy Judge for the District of Delaware in Wilmington, and he serves as the Bankruptcy Judge Representative on the Third Circuit Judicial Council. He previously served as a U.S. Bankruptcy Judge for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. We also have with us two professors, Professor Richard Lieb, who is Research Professor at St. John's University School of Law. He submitted an amicus brief in the case on the side of Vicki Lynn Marshall, aided by law students at St. John's University. And Professor Todd Zawicki of George Mason University School of Law is the GMU Foundation Professor of Law and editor of the Supreme Court Economic Review. He joined an amicus brief in the case supporting the side of Pierce Marshall. So, Professor Zawicki, since you were on the winning side, I think you get to go first, and I'd like to hear what you were trying to accomplish in the amicus that you joined, and how satisfied are you with the decision that came down yesterday?
Thanks, Jean, and thanks to ABI for putting this together on this case, which I think, you know, all of us in the bankruptcy world knew this was going to be an important case, but I don't think very many of us anticipated really how important this case is going to be and how broad the Supreme Court opinion turned out to be. Because, of course, one of the things that's interesting about this, as you alluded to, Jean, is that while the court could have taken the narrow route and really relegated this more as a bankruptcy question by avoiding the constitutional question and instead treating it as a statutory question about the jurisdictional scope of Section 157. Instead, they reached the constitutional question, as you noted, in so doing, it has broad implications for the federal judicial system generally, not just with respect to bankruptcy, but with respect to a whole host of issues that might arise under Article 1 and that sort of thing. So from that perspective, it's just an extraordinary and potentially far-reaching opinion. The reason I got interested in this case from the beginning was really what I was concerned about driving this case was the forum shopping issue, which is that this looks exactly like, as Marcus Cole and I say in our law review article that we wrote on this, this looks like the forum shopping nightmare, that we've got exactly the kind of problem that we are most concerned about in bankruptcy, which is a perfectly competent court in Texas interpreting Texas law and a probate court and doing so in a timely manner such that to allow the Texas court to have run its course in this situation would not have delayed the administration of her estate at all in any meaningful way and would have gotten a much better result, I think, a much more accurate result as to what Texas law would be. And instead, what we had was what looked like Anna Nicole Smith essentially ginning up as far as we could tell, a relatively bogus bankruptcy petition. She form shopped her way into court in what seems to be a completely manufactured default judgment for a sexual harassment suit by her former maid, who then immediately dropped the suit basically after she filed bankruptcy. So. And that is what triggered the whole procedure going forward in bankruptcy court. When you recognize how easy that would allow it to be able to create a bankruptcy jurisdiction, and you see in a case like this where the bankruptcy judge was so willing to reach out and decide these issues rather than just allowing the Texas probate court to run its course, you start to see how, if the Supreme Court decided this case the other way around, we could really be talking about opening the floodgates for forum shopping in terms of getting a completely different result in bankruptcy court than you might get under state law. And that's what's really concerned me about this case in the beginning and why I got interested in it and filed amicus briefs and written on it and that sort of thing. From that perspective, I think the court does do that, which is that one of the things that concerned me about the Ninth Circuit's resolution of the case, which is I think they got the result right, but that the reasoning they used I thought was very narrow, which is that the Ninth Circuit basically, by treating it as through the core non-core question, essentially left open the fact that all that would have been required would have been if the bankruptcy court had been faster, then it would have been okay. And the idea that jurisdiction questions should turn on who's the fastest is not a plausible way of running this this railroad. So from that perspective, I'm glad that the Supreme Court took a larger structural approach to it, thought more about the real sound jurisdictional issues rather than allowing that sort of ad hoc sort of approach that the Ninth Circuit had allowed. And I think that fundamentally they're right here. I'll say the last thing that's interesting to me is, as I read Justice Scalia's concurrence, it strikes me that he would have gone even further, that Justice Scalia's concurrence expresses real skepticism about the idea of Article I courts generally, and I think we see that pretty strongly in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion as well. In that sense, it's really a pretty striking paring back of you know some of the more loosey-goosey language we've seen over the 20 years or 30 years since Marathon, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not this augurs further steps in this direction as the Supreme Court becomes sort of more formalistic about separation of powers and jurisdictional questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Todd, and I'm glad you mentioned some of the other background of this case. In my introduction, I couldn't begin to get into all the twists and turns, but you're right that there was a Texas court decision for Pierce Marshall on the defamation claim, so we did have a kind of dueling courts phenomenon here with the bankruptcy court deciding for Vicki and the Texas state court deciding for Pierce. I would like to turn now to Professor Lieb, who was also involved in the case, submitting an amicus brief on the side of Vicki, and with the help of some law students at St. John's. What were you trying to accomplish, and how do you see the decision yesterday?
Thank you, Jean. First, let me talk about who really wrote the amicus brief that I signed as the counsel of record. I did work on it, but I teach a course in amicus brief writing in the LLM bankruptcy program at St. John's, and the brief was a product of the course. And the bulk of the research and much of the writing was done by the students. And I'll let them take the credit since our side lost the case rather than taking it myself. But they did a wonderful job. They learned a lot from it. And the format of the course is, after completing the brief, is that the students are taken on a trip to hear the oral arguments, which is a wonderful experience for them in a great court, although I think the court went off in the wrong direction in this case. The brief was written on behalf of 12 law professors as the amici, and they, by and large, had a concern that I shared rather deeply, namely that the potential of outcome of this case could result in a significant cutback in the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy judges, complicate bankruptcy cases, increase the cost of bankruptcy, increase the delays in completing bankruptcies, both large and particularly small ones. And I think those concerns were well expressed in Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion. The concerns that he expressed was actually scuffed off, but a minor comment on it in the opinion for the court by Justice Roberts, who said that they just did not share the concerns at all that were expressed by Justice Breyer. I think they are real concerns. I think the example that he gave in his dissenting opinion, which Jean mentioned in her introduction, namely a counterclaim against a landlord who filed a rent claim and a counterclaim for breach of the lease by the landlord, is precisely a state law, common law claim, and one which I think at the very end of Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion on page 17, I'm just trying to turn to his language here, which I'll have in a moment, where he said that what this is going to lead to is a jurisdictional ping pong between courts would lead to inefficiency, increased cost, delay, and needlessly additional suffering among those faced with bankruptcy. He said on page 16, under the majority's holding, the federal district judge, not the bankruptcy judge, would have to hear and reserve this the counterclaim by the debtor estate against the landlord. So he's really opened up the door to this. And I think what our concern in filing the brief, which I think has now matured into a reality, is that there is going to be a great deal of litigation over counterclaims and who will decide them, whether it will be in the bankruptcy court, the district court. I think there's going to be a lot of litigation on it. Now, there was one other aspect of the decision that really caught my eye. You know, some say that footnotes are not important, but sometimes they are very important. And I'm referring to footnote 7 of the court's decision on page 27, which I'll have in a moment. With what? Where the court said in discussing in that footnote, the Gran Financiera, its decision in Gran Financiera, that in that case, it did not mean to suggest that the restructuring of debtor-creditor relations is in fact a public right. If it were a public right, then, of course, that would be within the traditional court-made exception to a requirement of an Article III determination. And what the court is saying, they were not suggesting that this basic notion of restructuring of debtor-creditor relations would be a public right. They say because neither party asked us to reconsider the public rights framework for bankruptcy, we follow the same approach here, the old approach. So that it's kind of startling that they left open that question, and I'm surprised they viewed it as not having been raised by a petitioner. Perhaps it wasn't clearly enough, but there is a wide open question as to what is the nature of the public rights exception insofar as it pertains to the framework of bankruptcy. Now, that's very important because the notion of restructuring of debtor-creditor relations has been long since established in a long line of Supreme Court decisions as that being at the core of bankruptcy. Pardon me. That was the tone of the Northern Pipeline decision. So that what we have is a wide open, important question. Now, I have a kind of a fundamental reaction to the majority's decision, and it's a significant reminder of the days of the Burger Court, Chief Justice Burger, and the Northern Pipeline decision. And before that decision, some of you, but not many of you, will recall that bankruptcy was viewed rather dimly by the Article III judiciary, perhaps with some good reason, which were well documented in the 1977 and 78 reports of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees that led to the Bankruptcy Code, because of inadequacies in the referee system and the way it had functioned in the earlier days. And there was an area of elitism. And I think that that notion may have continued forward, and I sense it in the decision of the court in this Stern against Marshall case, because the court easily could have gone the other way on a number of grounds, but hewed very close to the line of no leeway, really, for Article III deviations. So I think that the object of the amicus brief that I was involved in was not accomplished. Its worries have matured, and I think we're in for some significant litigation and upset in the system as a result of this case.
All right. Well, thank you very much for those comments, and the point about footnote 7 in the last sentence there is quite fascinating, that we may have another sally on the whole question here, once perhaps some law professors develop the public rights theory of debtor-creditor restructuring. So that's a really fascinating possibility. The other thing I wanted to pick up on from your comments, Professor Leib, is the point about some elitism being expressed by Article III judges. And since we have an Article I judge with us, Judge Carey, I'm wondering if he's feeling a bit beaten up by this decision. But also, since as always happens with Supreme Court cases, it gets what they say then has to be put into action in the bankruptcy system. So what implications does this have? Are we going to have this kind of clogged docket in the federal courts? Meanwhile, the bankruptcy judges sitting around twiddling their thumbs. Judge Carey.
Well, let me begin by giving my usual disclaimer by saying whatever I say here today shouldn't be considered a prejudgment on any issue related to this that might come before me. Mm-hmm. There have historically been the tensions that Professor Leib has described between the Article III and the Article I courts. But really, from my standpoint, the first question I ask myself is what difference will the Supreme Court's decision make? First of all, we routinely face challenges of jurisdiction. But the decision, as I read it, does not say that bankruptcy judges don't have the jurisdiction to decide these matters. What the difference is the nature of the decision that we make. When we can make a final judgment or enter a final order on a matter, the next step is an appeal in our circuit to the district court. If it's the kind of matter that the Supreme Court was considering, they're not saying we can't hear it and decide it, but the form of the decision comes in the form of a recommendation to the district court. Well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is the standard under which the district court would review our decision. Under a standard of a report and recommendation, they consider the matter de novo, so the losing party gets another full shot at trying to make its case. On appeal, the general rule is decisions of law the district court can consider on its own as if it were taking them in the first instance. Findings of fact by the bankruptcy court are considered are subject to appeal only if they're found to be clearly erroneous. So it doesn't really change and might not change in most instances what we hear and what we decide, but what may change and what will change certainly in some matters is the title of the decision that we render. What's likely to happen in the way of strategy that parties might employ? Well, I'm thinking that it may be that bankruptcy courts would be more inclined to abstain from matters raised by compulsory counterclaim that don't necessarily have to be decided in connection with the proof of claim contest. I don't read the decision of the Supreme Court as saying that if the issues in the proof of claim are implicated by the counterclaim, I don't read this decision to take that the bankruptcy court can't decide it. But here, the Supreme Court said the issues aren't related to each other, so it's a compulsory counterclaim that can stand alone. So maybe bankruptcy courts will be more inclined to let other courts, like in this case the state court, make a decision on that discrete issue. It may be that the issues will be so intertwined the bankruptcy court will end up deciding it anyway. It may be that parties who don't want to be in front of a bankruptcy judge will ask the district court to withdraw the reference. But I will tell you, it's my experience, district courts, especially busy ones, are not looking to do additional work. And they'll typically keep a matter in the bankruptcy court until it's ready for trial. So one of the things I think is not going to change is the bankruptcy court is probably likely to hear all of the pretrial matters that may come up in connection even with a matter like the one that was before the Supreme Court, even if it's the district court that ultimately has to try it, or it's a decision in which the bankruptcy judge just makes a recommendation. The majority makes clear, as others have said, that it's the Article III courts who are the experts, not the bankruptcy courts here. And I do think it's a further confirmation of ultimately the Article III court's authority to make the decisions in bankruptcy. Bankruptcy courts, as many of you know, do what they do by virtue of standing orders of referral, I think, in almost every district in the country, which the statute permits. But ultimately, the bankruptcy authority does rest in the district court.
And Judge Carey, do you have a sense of how common, how frequently in bankruptcy cases you would have something like this where there's a tort claim by the debtor and then there's a counterclaim on a, on another tort. I'm sorry, there was a tort claim by a creditor and then a counterclaim by the debtor. This seems like it might not be that common.
It's really, well, in my experience, it's not that common. And, of course, this case was highly publicized. There were lots of dollars involved. And so it stands out as we all hear and read about it. But in my experience, these situations are not all that common. And a lot of the time, the parties, from a practical matter, even with respect to a party who does not want to be before a bankruptcy judge but is forced to be because of the operation of the rules, will consent to the bankruptcy courts making a final decision simply because much of the time cases move more rapidly in a bankruptcy court and are decided quicker. Between consent of the parties, settlements, many of the contested matters get settled in any event. This was one of those that, for the reasons, as you read the description of the different claims, that was not going to be settled and ultimately wasn't.
Right. And if I could just have one more follow-up with you on the point that Professor Zawicki raised about forum shopping, I wonder whether we might not still have some forum shopping. I mean, we have plenty of it now, right? But among bankruptcy courts, but forum shopping with the look to, well, maybe some cause of action will go to the federal court, but at least it won't be in the state court, so that isn't there still some potential there for that?
You correctly point out that we already have plenty of decisions made by parties strategically who determine where they think their issue or dispute can best be heard or resolved in a way, of course, most favorable, at least as they perceive it, to them. I would say in the pot of forum shopping situations, you know, maybe there's just one more ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let me give Professor Zawicki a chance to come back in here. I'm sure there are some points you might want to respond to in what the other panelists have said.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was interesting was the observation mod footnote 7 and whatnot, and I think that's something interesting that's worth coming back to here, because as I read that as basically being a response to Justice Scalia's short concurrence, and I do think that's an interesting thing to watch, because the majority opinion here is really quite formalistic. It goes into a lot of the history of separation of powers and that sort of thing. And really, as the other commenters have noted, kind of just sets aside logistical questions and basically says, look, justice and the Constitution is not about being expeditious. It's about upholding the rule of law and certain structural powers. Justice Roberts invokes, King George and the independence of the judiciary from the king. I mean, he's going all the way back into history and basically saying, look, it really is the case that, that whether or not justice is fast, whether it's rapid, that sort of thing, is a secondary consideration as to whether or not it's truly justice. And I think, so in that sense, I think the criticism of the majority opinion was right on. But also, for Justice Roberts, and clearly for Justice Scalia as well, it simply misses the point that I think would be their point. And in many ways, then, it just looks like a lot of these sort of things, whether it was, if you remember, the INS versus Chadha case involving the one house veto in Congress, a lot of these sort of structural constitutional cases look like this, where they basically say, okay, you're right, maybe it would be faster and easier and cheaper to do it that way, but that's not what the Constitution is about. And so I think in that sense, it really is a relatively small consideration for Chief Justice Roberts and the majority as to whether that's the case. The final thing I'll say on that jumped out at me in reading the opinion is one of the points that Justice Roberts says is the real concern with Article I courts is that Congress can basically evade the separation of powers by setting up certain courts and then delegating them powers to resolve disputes that judges can never reach, and that the purpose of Article III is not just to protect the judiciary, but also to protect individual litigants. The final point on that I would just add is I think these statements about the scope of the public rights doctrine in the opinions are really quite provocative, and Justice Scalia is pretty aggressive on this, where he pretty strongly implies that, in his view, bankruptcy is not public rights, which is that what he seems to say is a public right is solely a right against the government, and that to the extent that what bankruptcy is a multi-party private litigation, I think that if pressed, Justice Scalia would almost certainly say that this is not a public, it's not public rights, it's private rights, it's just a different procedure for resolving it, And I think you can read in Justice Scalia's opinion the notion that the whole apparatus of bankruptcy as being an Article I procedure may be unconstitutional, and that one option would be to make bankruptcy judges into Article III judges, or another option would be completely restructuring the bankruptcy system. Obviously, the majority doesn't go quite that far, but it wouldn't take a lot of effort, I think, to find that same principle and that same sort of shot across the bow in the majority's opinion.
Well, that's a really interesting perspective that, you have the possibility that maybe we're going to go further with, sort of unconstitutionality of the bankruptcy system, or maybe we'll go back once this is reexamined under a public rights theory. I think that's perhaps enough for the opening commentary. We do have.
May I just join in?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I did want to open it up to the audience.
I'll just take a moment. I'd like to pick up on the last point. In trying to get our arms around what the court really held and the scope of its decision, there's a very interesting statement on page 34 of the court's opinion where it states that the question really is, and I'm quoting, whether the action at issue stems from the bankruptcy itself or would necessarily be resolved in the claims allowance process. Now, that's something that Justice Scalia did join in. And I think given that question and the decision of the court, I think there's grave doubt that the court in a future case is going to upset the entire bankruptcy system in light of that test. I just had one or two other comments.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I'm glad you made it. Yeah, go ahead, and then we'll open it up.
Well, I was thinking about the discussion of consent to the bankruptcy judge's determination of something otherwise requiring an Article III determination. And that's built into the bankruptcy system in Section 157C1, where the parties may consent to the bankruptcy judge adjudicating such matter. I think the problem that may come up in some cases, however, is where consent is lacking, the case goes up and you get to either the district court or a court of appeals, and the party raises for the first time that the bankruptcy judge lacked subject matter jurisdiction. And that can be, of course, raised at any time. And I think that is a potential for some real complications in some hotly contested cases. I want just to point that out.
Okay. Well, I do want to give our audience a chance to ask the panelists questions. So, Jake, we're ready to take questions from the audience.
Very well. If you wish to ask a question today, you can signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Keep in mind, if you have been using your speakerphone, ensure the mute function has been released to allow your signal to reach the equipment. Once again, if you would like to ask a question today, you can signal by pressing star 1. We'll pause for just a moment to see if there's any responses. We will take our first question from James Teamstra with Teamstra Law Group.
Yeah, this is Jim Teamstra. I would just had a question about how the panelists view the continuing viability of Section 157 now that it's been called into question, at least in part. Is there a necessity for immediate action by Congress? Is there a need for instance, an emergency order again, as there was in 1982? How do the panelists see that as practically being handled?
Is there one of you who particularly wants to answer that question?
Well, this is Judge Carey. I don't see this as a marathon-like type of event.
Uh-huh.
And while Congress may very well act, I certainly haven't seen any appetite to expand the authority of the bankruptcy courts to make final decisions in various things. I don't necessarily think that Congress will be looking to do the opposite either.
Right, and just to clarify, when you mentioned marathon, that marathon was a decision what was that, 1984?
Oh, 82.
82, right, where basically the whole operation of the bankruptcy court was found unconstitutional, so there was a necessity to do something. This is a narrower decision, right?
This is really one for the courts to work through, and they should be able to do that easily.
Okay, do we have another question?
No additional questions in the queue, but I will remind everyone, star 1 if you have a question.
Okay. While we're waiting, I'm wondering, you know, what this issue about delay and cost, is this going to be primarily a problem in consumer cases? Is it going to be a problem in all sorts of cases? Or maybe it's not going to be that big a problem at all. Do you have
I think the problem is going to come up where there are property disputes and state law issues and state law claims. And I think they can come up in commercial or consumer cases. I'm not sure where the prevalence will be, but that's, I think, the type of controversy. Property ownership, property rights, which is going to generate the issues.
And the smaller the dollar stakes, the more difficult it may be to deal with this more complex procedure, right, on a cost-effective basis.
I think that's right.
I would expect, I'd be interested in the judges' responses. I mean, my expectation would be that, you know, that we're going to see a lot of these cases that the parties will just agree to bank. You know, that both parties, in most cases, both parties have an interest in expediting the procedure because, you know, time is money. There's usually not as much money, not that much at stake. And so my guess would be that in the overwhelming number of these cases, they'll just go ahead and consent to bankruptcy courts resolving these issues. And it's only going to be in cases like this where we're talking about, you know, massive numbers of dollars such that, you know, the speed is not that much of an issue. But that would be my sense, is that in you know, the vast number of cases, the parties will simply consent to allowing this to happen in the interest of speed and efficiency.
You may find otherwise where the dispute is with a bank or other financial institution over a mortgage in consumer cases, where the institution may want an Article III, may prefer an Article III court.
Very good point. That's a very good point.
And we'll have the funds to try to go wherever they can go. Forum shop, as you would say, Professor Zubicki.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a very good point, right, where they would be they prefer to have a district judge rather than a bankruptcy judge, for instance, to resolve it. I can see that. That's a fair point, no.
And it's usually parties who do have the financial wherewithal to make such arguments and carry on such litigation. I agree.
We ought to report them to what's-her-name running the new, who's with the new agency.
Oh, you're talking about the Elizabeth Warren's agency?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
We do have a couple of questions in the queue. We'll take a question from Don Adler with Finneran and Nicholson.
Hi, I'm Don Adler in Massachusetts. No constitutional, I don't understand all the constitutional issues, so let me try to get to some basic questions that I see. I have a case now, Chapter 7. The debtor was a tenant, and moved and had his property destroyed in about $15,000 or $20,000 in damages. We have scheduled his claim against his former landlord. Is this a type of claim that the Stern versus Marshall case is addressing? Does the bankruptcy court have the jurisdiction under this decision to decide a state common law issue?
Hey, your question is about a debtor's claim, right?
I'm getting to how expansive is the Supreme Court's decision into what areas. I'm trying to get to what the practicality is of this. What areas it's going to actually, in consumer cases, what areas it's going to actually impact.
It sounded like Professor Lieb wanted to answer.
Okay.
Well, no, I was going to suggest that, although it's not a counterclaim, but a primary claim.
That's right.
That,
right.
I think Justice Breyer's dissent strongly suggests that it would be a lack of jurisdiction absent consent under Section 157C1 of Title 28. I think it's a real question as to whether there is jurisdiction.
Okay. Would that be the same?
Pardon me? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Would that be the same conclusion you would draw where there was a divorce and a property either settlement or judgment arising out of the divorce, out of a state court action, and the debtor seeks to discharge the former spouse as a creditor, looking to discharge the property, either settlement or property settlement claim or judgment. And the creditor files an adversary proceeding, a non-dischargeability adversary proceeding. Is this a dispute that where it arises out of state court decision, judgment, is this a dispute that the bankruptcy court does not have jurisdiction over?
Not going to touch that one. I think it raises different issues.
Well, I'd like to ask Judge Carey, with the reminder that anything he says is not to be taken as a ruling, that you could take to his court.
Well, I don't think I'll be before him. I'm in Massachusetts. Practice a little bit down in New York and throughout New England, but not where the judge is sitting.
All the professors need to be writing down all these great exam questions.
I wish I was back in law school.
I'm not going to weigh in specifically on that issue, but again, I think the questions that are being raised are more akin to marathon-like type issues and go to, you know, not whether a court can hear and decide it, but what the form of the decision is,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a final order or a report and recommendation to the district court. So, I'm not so sure that on a practical day-to-day basis, especially in a consumer-type of case, whether there will be much change. Now, look, you say that a Supreme Court decision has just been issued, the ink is still wet.
Yep.
It can have implications, and we'll just, as one of the professors said, we'll have to see how the courts address it, and I think that's correct.
Okay, thank you both very much.
I do think your question raises another area of inquiry, namely the impact of a state court judgment in the later federal bankruptcy proceeding. That's something that warrants consideration.
We see that issue regularly.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a whole body of law that addresses that those disputes.
Right. Okay,
all right,
thank you.
I think we probably have time for one more question if there's someone waiting.
And we'll take that question from Patrick Scott with Gray Robinson.
Hi, thank you. My question is about whether this is a shot across the bow in any way on the subject of, for example, the broad jurisdiction that some bankruptcy courts exercise now, and I think there's a debate over whether it's permissible or not. On declaratory judgment actions regarding insurance policies. In some asbestosis cases, courts have held that the mere fact that their determinations may have some effect on the claims process and the amount of sharing of pooled recoveries in those cases gives them the jurisdiction to determine deck actions on insurance policies. And it's big. There is some big debate about it in cases around the country. Is this decision in some way attacking the bankruptcy court's ability to decide all state law matters more than merely addressing the state law matters that were previously responsive to proofs of claim?
The best answer I can give to that is I don't know, but I'll point you to what the majority said at page 34 is the question, and that is whether the action at issue stems from the bankruptcy itself or would necessarily be resolved in the claims allowance process. And I can see that there may be arguments that would remove the situation that you refer to from the bankruptcy courts.
They actually made a point at page 32 or 33 that there was never any reason to believe that the process of adjudicating the stepson, the Pierce's proof of claim, would necessarily resolve Vicky's counterclaim. And they used that to distinguish Catch and Be Dandy.
That's clear in several places in the opinion that the resolution of the claim itself filed by the creditor must be determinative of the claim against the creditor.
All right. Well, I think we're going to have to wind this up. We're out of time, and I think we've gotten the sense that the courts are going to have a lot to wrestle with. This is what always happens with Supreme Court decisions, that the lower courts then have to figure out exactly what it means for other sorts of cases. I want to thank our panelists, Judge Carey and Professors Lieb and Zwicky, and that will conclude our ABI teleconference.